Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
The book, The New Political Capitalism, bridges the gap between the reality of the relationship between politics and business. This new book challenges the notion that business is, or can ever be, apolitical. It argues that politics, the visible reflection of social values and cultural trends, shapes the environment in which businesses operate. Joel Zammit-Lucia, author of The New Political Capitalism, joins us this morning to talk about the book. Joe, thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Let's start with having you define what is new political capitalism.
So throughout the sort of late part of the 20th century, say 70s, 80s, 90s, the window of political ideas, the window of political debate was relatively narrow. We all believed that liberal democracy had won the battle of political ideas, that we could all live in a nice globalized world, that neoliberal economics was the way forward and there was no alternative. So the window of political debate was narrow, and business could not quite ignore it, but it didn't impact business that much. So they could get on with the business of making money. Of course, where we find ourselves now is that window of political debate has been blown wide open. We're in the middle of a war in Europe. We have China being seen as a political and economic rival. Everything has been essentially thrown out of balance. So that the battle of political ideas, including the culture wars that we're seeing, is starting to affect how business operates in a way that it hadn't in the latter part of the 20th century. So we're getting to what I call a new political capitalism, where political considerations become central to how business operates.
Yeah, one of the things that I thought was interesting in the book was that you talk about how many business people want to say, just shrug their shoulders and say, look, our business is making money. We really don't have any interest in political issues. That just doesn't work anymore, does it?
No, it doesn't work, and to an extent it has never worked. It's just that the tempo has increased dramatically because there are so many more issues today that affect business. You know, business is not somehow separate from society. It's embedded in the society and the political units in which it operates. And it has to fit within that. So calling yourself apolitical just doesn't make any sense.
Let's then go into how we define political and politics. Many people, when they hear the word political, think of partisan politics. Is that what you're discussing?
So you're absolutely right. When you mention politics to people, they think about the electoral show and parties fighting each other. But that's not at all what I mean by politics in the book. What I mean by politics is the mechanism, the process by which we decide collectively what kind of societies we want to live in. Of course, political parties putting alternative points of view of that is part of that. But that's simply the mechanism of politics. It's not politics. And if you define politics in this way, how we decide what sort of society we want to live in, there can't be a human being on earth who doesn't care about that and who doesn't have an impact on that.
So let's talk about how the pressures from political issues have shifted in the last few years. You talk about a term, financialized capitalism, which I take it as the sort of historical notion that the job of a public corporation is simply to enhance shareholder profits. But that's really, again, that's another thing that's just not going to work anymore. Talk to us about why that isn't sustainable.
So, you know, the process of financialized capitalism, as you say, that business was only about shareholder value, and in fact that a lot of the supposed value that we're creating in our economies is no longer coming from industrial production and industrial work, but it's coming from the financial industry trading with itself. So everything has been financialized. And that was seen as the right way to go in the late 20th century. But now we have lots of other concerns. We're concerned about our environment. We're concerned about climate change. We're concerned about social and financial inequalities. We're concerned about the quality of our education. We're concerned about geopolitical tensions. So all these things now impact what form of capitalism we want. And it has to be a form of capitalism that takes all these things into consideration somehow, rather than just this idea, which is nice and attractive, that you only have one objective and you can ignore everything else.
Somehow, I don't think Milton Friedman would agree with this, but...
Right. I've mentioned in some of my writings in the past that Milton Friedman may go down as one of the economists who's done most harm to our societies.
Really interesting question, and one we could take up on another time. Go ahead, Allison.
So one of the stories that started to get my mind wrapped around this concept was the example of the Swiss banking industry and banking secrecy, and a change that took place due to political climate. Can you walk through how that decision was made?
Sure. So as we know, the Swiss banking industry was for a very long time dependent and made it its kind of unique selling point. It's banking secrecy laws in Switzerland. So you could put money in Switzerland and nobody would ever know about it. It was watertight. Well, that started to become unacceptable as financial crime increased, as money laundering increased, as tax evasion increased. So we saw a change in the political climate from a situation over a long period of time, from a situation when banking secrecy was seen as a reasonable thing and Switzerland specialized in it, to a situation where other countries had a say in this because they were losing revenues, and where the idea of banking secrecy became politically less attractive. So the Swiss banking industry saw this coming and said, okay, we have to adapt. This is not going to go away. So they changed what the Swiss financial service industry was dependent on. It took them some time. They worked to slow down the process, to give them time for adaptation. But they adapted, and they're just as successful as they are before. Now, the difference we're seeing today is that cultural changes like that used to happen over very long periods of time, giving industries chances to adapt slowly. What we're seeing today is that cultural expectations are changing at a hugely rapid pace, which means that the pace of change in response has to be just as rapid.
Another interesting story you tell in the book that relates to the sort of evolution of the relationship between government and business centers around the Boeing MAX situation, which, you know, when I followed that story, I never really thought of it in the way that you sort of explain as an evolution.
Yes. So, you know, what happened in the aviation industry, and Boeing is a relatively unique company, not because of what it makes, but because it is accounts for a good slice of US GDP and exports, and because as a large, huge company, most of its employees are in the US. So it is very important to the US economy, which is positive in one way, but also gives it quite a lot of political power. And over time, there were regulatory changes. And more of the regulatory burden was put within the company itself. And regulators had people sitting within the companies to do these regulatory checks. Line, if you like, the line in the sand between what is industrial concern of Boeing building its planes and what is a political concern, which is regulating that and making sure they're safe, that line started to become blurred. We had regulatory people or people with regulatory tasks sitting within a company and trying to do it from there for efficiency reasons. Well, that didn't quite work, and we all know the history of the 737 MAX, that essentially it was not safe when it was launched. Those things have now been put right, I understand. And we had two crashes. And there were several regulatory failings that showed that this system of essentially blurring the lines between what belongs to the political and what belongs to the industrial just didn't work. So we need to be careful in how we manage that interaction between the political and the commercial.
I feel that, you know, one of the other examples that fall into that is VW's diesel engines, of when, you know, politics loses its way by forgetting what it's supposed to be about.
Yes. So, you know, VW, again, is a very important company in the German economy, and particularly in the economy of Lower Saxony, which is the state where VW lives. In fact, the government of Lower Saxony has got a big stake in VW and depends on dividends from that stake to fund its activities. So here we have a German government that is very dependent on the automobile industry for the German economy. We have a Lower Saxony government that is very dependent on a company for employment, for prosperity in the state, and for its own revenues. So once again, the dividing lines between what is properly commercial and what is properly political are totally blurred. And it's interesting that the VW diesel engine scandal came to light because of American regulators, not because of German regulators. So again, it starts to make you wonder that once you blur these lines, are you doing your political and regulatory job well enough?
You also had a really interesting observation, which where you talk about how many people who think the government should just stay out of business ignore the fact that the existence of contracts, the enforcement of courts, there are all these elements of government that fundamentally allow businesses to thrive. So the idea that it can be totally separate was, as you said before, was never really accurate.
No, it never was. I mean, just to get to basics, if you own a company, what is a company? A company is simply a concept defined in law. In other words, it's a concept defined by the government, defined by the political system. So simply the idea of owning a company and what a company can and cannot do already enmeshes business and politics. And if you and I are trying to make money, what is money? Money is something issued by the government and guaranteed by the government. So even the process of making money itself is political.
I want to ask you a question about something that wasn't in the book, but that as I was reading the book really struck me, and it's very current. And that is the increasing tension between companies and restricted abortion policies in certain states, and the notion that many companies are offering to pay transportation costs for employees to leave the state to receive abortions. And there's been a sharp reaction to that by a lot of state governments. How do you see that playing out, and how does that fit into this model we're talking about?
This is part of the culture wars, and companies are being drawn into this, whether it's gay rights, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whatever. and it's difficult to deal with, particularly for an issue like abortion, where you have two sides of an argument, and both of those sides believe passionately that they have the moral high ground. So there is no room for compromise. It's a very visceral and difficult issue. So for a company who risks being drawn into this, there are several questions, sets of questions. The first one is, what does this mean for how I run my business? And many companies have addressed that question and are addressing it, as you pointed out, in how they handle their healthcare benefits. Now, whatever they decide, they're not going to please everybody because it's just impossible to do that. But they have to run their business and they have to have healthcare plans and they have to make those decisions. So those implications of the abortion debate are rightly to be considered by business in terms of how they run their operations. Some are arguing that business should come out and take a stand pro or against abortion. And essentially become activist in this debate. Now, different businesses will choose whether to do that or not. But once one wades into that, then, you know, one can easily hit a morass from which there is very little room for exit. So, you know, the abortion debate and all the other culture war issues that are arising make it necessary for business to develop political skills around their leadership team in how to handle these very difficult issues, which are very fuzzy, for which there's no right answer, and in which business, you know, has not had a history of swimming.
A lot of the examples that we're talking about have to do with adaptation to a response to a certain either policy or change in culture. Can you give us an example of a business that took their own kind of initiative and went and kind of focused on contributing to the larger society at hand, which is now benefiting their business?
Sure, there are several, but not a lot in the universe of businesses. So everybody, and I apologize for this, but everybody goes back to the same examples, which you know end up being things like Patagonia and Ben and Jerry's. You know, Patagonia was founded by a gentleman who loved the outdoors and loved the environment, and it was founded and developed as a company with environmental activism at the core of what it's about. And the whole business model, their whole customer base, the whole way they market themselves is inbuilt into the DNA of the brand that this is an environmental activist company. So from the very start, it was essentially a political corporation, making a political issue core to how it runs its business. Now, there aren't many businesses like that. You know, Ben and Jerry's is one of them. Some would argue companies like Hobby Lobby that take a very Christian values view of life. But in the past, this was not uncommon. I mean, you know, the Quakers who came to the United States, they had these values and set up their businesses based on values first and making money as a consequence. So it's not new.
So before we go, I want to sort of go back to Milton Friedman, only in the sense that we are moving toward a model where corporations are really overtly saying that they need to serve more than one set of stakeholders, that is, more than the shareholders. Talk a little bit about that evolution, and where do you think it's going from here?
So I think that evolution is now, seems, at the, looking at it now, it seems inevitable. It started, and in my view, it will continue to accelerate. And it makes life difficult, but it just brings us back to what we all have to do in life, which is to trade off multiple considerations. And different companies will decide to trade off those considerations in different ways. The difficulty with being a kind of stakeholder business is that every stakeholder wants different things from you. Just like in politics, almost every citizen wants something different. So it's that skill of managing all that. But rather than thinking about it in terms of stakeholder capitalism, I prefer to think about it, as is obvious from the title of my book, as political capitalism. Because what we're talking about here, to try and simplify it and make it more manageable, is that the culture around you and the expectations around you have changed and will continue to change. So how do you run a business successfully in a world that is changing in this sort of socio-cultural way? That's the question, I think, that people have to ask, rather than descend into measuring this and measuring that and measuring whether I'm favoring this stakeholder rather than that stakeholder, etc., which is a recipe for chaos, in my view.
Right before we go, I just want to go back to one of the examples that you had in the book where I feel like it was really forefront, the message that the company was making, and that was Benetton with their ads back in the 80s, early 90s.
Yes. So Benetton was an interesting company, and, you know, they were operating in, you know, a very crowded near commodity market of sort of good quality, whatever that means, good quality high street clothing. So how do you differentiate yourself? And they decided to make social issues their differentiated point. And because they also believed that they had a role to do something about it. So they had this series of very, very hard-hitting ads attacking the death penalty, attacking wars here and there, attacking injustice here and there. And their ads were essentially a social activism campaign. Their products were never even mentioned. They just had the corporate logo on these ads. But they created a lot of noise. Some magazines refused to take them because they were so hard-hitting. And they created a brand that was associated with this edgy social warrior type of image, which differentiated them very substantially in what was a near commodity market. That took a lot of skill and a lot of time to build. But it was hugely successful. And their sales went down when they reverted to being just another clothing brand.
I appreciate the time that you've spent with us this morning. We've been speaking with Joe Zammitlucia. He is the author of the new book, The New Political Capitalism. Joe, thank you for joining us this morning at Mountain Money.
Lovely to be with you. Thanks for the time.
Utah, with its world-class ski resorts, its national parks, and its endless opportunity for year-round outdoor recreation, has been a major draw for consumers to our variety and quality of life. Paul Benson, one of Utah's leading real estate professionals, recently announced the opening of 3 new Engel and Volker shop locations here in the state, in addition to the more than 30 locations for which he is the licensed broker. Welcome to Mountain Money, Paul, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the invite. Good morning.
So let's talk a little bit about the big picture. Tell us a little bit about what client demand for real estate has been looking like in the last, say, 90 days to year. And how does that compare with other areas here in the Mountain West?
We have definitely seen a slowdown over the last 90 days, no question. But it's still much higher than what we have seen in the past. Last year was the biggest year for any mountain resort as far as real estate transactions and volume and prices and all of those things we talk about. This year, prices, however, have not come down, even though we're seeing the slowdown. You know, the sellers are still fairly committed to the prices. It is still at more of a seller's market than a buyer's market, but a lot less transactions. A lot of it has to do with the fear of what's happening with the stock market, what's happening with interest rates. But the desire of the buyers to be in a mountain town like Park City is still, it's still there. It has a lot to do with the cities and some of the stories you're hearing in the other and outside in the bigger cities as far as crime, and it's driving people to us.
I don't want to blindside you, but let me ask you if we can do some definitions of normal in terms of days of inventory.
Sure.
Help me understand what would normal be and where are we relative to, quote, normal in terms of that kind of a metric.
Oh, absolutely. Prior to COVID, traditionally, inventory in Park City would range somewhere between 4,000 properties. That's condos, land, homes, even fractions would be in there, as high as 6,000. We got down into the 600 range last year, and now we're hovering in the low 1,000 range, 11 to 1,200, depending on the week. So if you look at it as a base level, it's so much worse than last year, right? Mm-hmm. But it is still historically low.
you recently just opened 3 new offices, and the locations are Holiday, St. George, and Camas. Tell me what's going on in those communities that made Engels and Boker want to have an office in that location.
Absolutely. One word, California. Everybody moving here, right? But it's different across the board. We think of the Mountain West and we think of this beautiful ski towns, but Salt Lake City had tremendous growth from, you know, new move-ins. And so Holiday for us, that was our first decision. That was a little over a year ago. It's just now opening because of the process. But, you know, it's Salt Lake has grown so fast that we were unable to service everything out of our Sugar House location. So Holiday allows us to really go into that Cottonwood Canyon area and so forth. St. George, a little different. You know, St. George, we're actually opening 2 locations at once right now. And St. George is not only benefiting from all of the other factors, but it's even benefiting from Park City. What really put it on the map for me is watching how many of my clients either bought a home to move there or to spend significant time there. So no longer just a golf weekend. Mm. Now it's, you know, the same reasons that are driving people to Park City, the national parks, you know, the outdoor life is driving people to St. George. It is growing so fast. But, you know, closer to our hearts, Camas, we know what the cost of living in Park City is right now and what it's doing to a lot of households. So the opportunity to keep that lifestyle that we, you know, that we moved here for, that Camas Valley really still offers that small town charm and that vibe, I'd say, that a lot of people are looking for in a mountain town. So, you know, had an opportunity to partner with the Smoot family, who's been in the Camas Valley for many years and has an amazing reputation, and their team is a very reputable, hardworking team. And there's a few projects going in down there, and so we really wanted to be part of that chapter. And so Main Street Camas, here we come.
You know, you bring up the partnership, and that sort of takes us as a segue. As a business show, I'm fascinated by the way different businesses operate. And you're going to open a new location in Holiday. The thing about a real estate brokerage is, like many other consulting and human capital firms, you know, your assets walk out the door every night. And then, you know, so how is it that you recruit and capitalize and create a new office in a place like Holiday? What's that process look like?
For us, the process starts with people. We've never woken up in the morning and said, we have to be in this location and let's go put a flag down and then figure it out. We find great people that we trust and believe in, and then from there we find an office that fits that group, and we grow with the people.
That's good to hear. With that, and listening to how you've talked about Utah population increasing due to people moving in, and then as well, you know, St. George, we're seeing people from within the state kind of staying within Utah. Is that a trend that we're going to see, or has the Mountain West really been discovered and it's just going to exponentially increase?
I think we're all asking the same question. Right now, even long after the conversation was always COVID, we're still seeing that migration. We just had a family last week moving in from the Bay Area that said, you know, we were vacationing here. We've skied here. We've even rented here in the summer, but now we are moving here and putting our kids in school here. We just have determined we can make this work. And I think the work from home thing, although it doesn't work for everybody, there's enough businesses that have made that long-term commitment that this can work. That when you think about who we are with the major, you know, Salt Lake City Airport, it's not just a major airport, it's an easy airport. It's an easy airport to get into a beautiful mountain town community that has enough services and amenities and hospital type things that you really need to still have the lifestyle that you had in the bigger city. You're also close to Salt Lake City, but it's so easy to get in and out of here.
So let's talk about interest rates. How do you see interest rates affecting demand? In other words, on the one hand, we have an increasing interest rate, which clearly increases the cost of a mortgage and buying a home. And against that, we have this secular trend that we're talking about, which is people wanting to move here. Talk to us a little bit about how you see the increases in interest rates affecting the local market.
You know, that one has been a little bit harder to communicate because obviously it's the talk of everything you read right now, sure, in the real estate world as to rising Fed rates. Well, the Fed rate right now is still fairly historically low. And the other factor, as you take a look at this over a 40-year trend, you see the Fed rate's historically low, but the gap between the Fed rate and the mortgage rate is historically high right now. So, you know, traditionally, it's really easy. I hear a lot of realtors state, you know, interest rates are always in the sixes and sevens, so we're right back to our average. You know, I actually... you know, my opinion's a little different in that I think that gap, even if we have another point rise, maybe another 2 points, the gap can still come down a little and keep the interest rates in the fives. So whether they're going to be in the sixes or the fives, I really don't see interest rates going up into the eights, nines, and tens. But what I am seeing is that you can now negotiate on a home a little bit. Whereas last year, you were paying over ask. You were in multiple offers. You were rushing. You were many times, frankly, overpaying. And now you have a little bit more time of availability to look at homes, to negotiate a little bit. So even though the interest rates are a little higher, there's a little bit of a gap now in the home price. So, you know, the cost of the homes hasn't changed that much.
You know, let's talk a little bit about time. We talked a little bit about the number of houses in inventory. What are we seeing in terms of the length of time that existing homes on the market are? Obviously, it's increasing. We've gone away from that, you know, put it up and it gets sold in a week. But talk to us a little bit about what you're seeing in terms of length of days on the market.
You know, Park City is so unique that way in terms of price points and neighborhood that it's probably a better way to say it is if it's brand new construction and priced right, it is still selling within the first few days.
Really?
Maybe not multiple offers, but sometimes we are still seeing some multiple offers on perfect product. If it's a home that needs more work, that is priced as if it didn't need more work, that home is probably going to sit for a while for a few reasons, not just price, but, you know, the construction industry is very difficult and expensive right now. So, you know, that's a home that's going to be much harder to sell. Your typical home in a place like Ranch Place, a desirable neighborhood, even though the prices may be substantially higher than any other time other than last year, it's still going to sell fast.
And you just gave a great segue into what I'm interested in hearing about, and that's construction. I know that there are incredibly long lead times in order to be able to get a new home constructed in this area, as well as we were going through some price increases, whether it be with lumber, we were having supply issues with concrete. Where are we now? What can you confidently say to people who are looking at land as far as availability of contractors and when they could actually get in the ground?
We are not there yet. So, you know, I live out in Promontory, and every morning if you leave, you know, in the early hours, you're going to see miles of contractors waiting to get into the gates. And pretty much on every street, there's something just now coming out of the ground. I was in Big Sky last week, and, you know, very similar story. Sun Valley, very similar story. You know, pretty much every mountain town, every development, whether it's Promontory or here, whether it's Toohey, Glenwald, you're going to see lines of trucks every morning waiting to get in. And because of that, there's clients that bought a home and or families that bought homes in the last couple of years that they either want to remodel it or they bought land and want to build. They are waiting for that moment for all of this to calm down. So, you know, the typical laws of supply and demand means there's still demand out there for years to come. So I don't see it calming down as much as push to slow down inflation would like.
So we talked a little bit about, you know, sort of inventory and length of time. The sort of interior Park City proper, and Snyderville Basin between here and the interstate, a lot of that land's been built on. There's not that much left to do. Talk to us about where development in this area is going to go in the future, a little bit about what's going on over by Mayflower in that area. Talk to us about where things are going to happen going forward.
Camas.
Now, yeah. No, Camas is it's an interesting, it's a serious answer, right?
Exactly. You know, it's Heber, Midway, Camas. You mentioned the Mayflower. You know, the Mayflower project, that's thousands of properties. You know, that's many, many, many years of building to come. And I don't think we really know what our town will look like yet when that's done. I'm personally very curious. You know, I'm very familiar with the projects, but I still can't picture that change 10 years from now. So I do think that, like you said, there's definitely the majority of the current town is built out. However, so is Aspen, so is Sun Valley, so is Vail. And so that's where you start seeing, you know, people coming in and taking the older homes and redoing them. And you're going to start seeing, I believe, neighborhoods, you know, entire neighborhoods where you just start really seeing that regentrification.
I feel that there's quite a few streets that I know within the neighborhood I live where there's been teardowns and rebuilds. And so I'm starting to see that, yeah, the marketplace at some level has hit that point. excuse me. When we've talked about all the growth, whether it be Mayflower, we know that Jordanelle area has quite a bit of development coming in. And we even had a great discussion with someone talking about the increase in population in our two counties, being Summit and Wasatch. Roger almost fell off his chair in one of them. What kind of expectations are those that are moving here given as far as like, this is it, this is beautiful, this is how it's going to be? Or do they really understand how much is out there as far as what's going to go on around them?
Really good questions. You know, I was laughing last year when you'd follow those Nextdoor apps and you'd see people that just moved out into Promontory and they were trying to figure out who was going to get rid of those holes in their yard from the pot bellies. Yeah. And they were really hoping the development would come remove those situations. So, you know, I think all joking aside, you know, we don't have 24-hour Uber. You know, we don't have restaurants open till 1 a.m. typically. So, you know, there does need to be a lot of, you know, a lot of discussion before somebody moves here full time. Or that, you know, I think it's one of the fears. I guess not fears. It's one of the things I'm watching as to how many people moved here over the last few years that really this isn't what they wanted, you know, and it's really hard. Like, I can't imagine being a school planner right now, trying to figure out what is my school population this year versus 3 years from now. So far, you know, the majority of people I run into that did move here over the last couple of years plan to stay, which, you know, some that I really didn't expect to hear that from. But it is something I have my eye on for sure.
Paul, are you seeing a significant number of people who are looking at the changes in the town and looking at the value of their homes and saying, I've had enough?
Interestingly, no.
Really?
You know, I would say there's a few factors. You know, other ski towns kind of ran out of land years ago, and we know where their prices are, and they're substantially higher than ours. So I think there's a belief we can still go higher because we are closer to that airport. We do have more infrastructure, more healthcare, more universities, and so forth close by. So I do believe that a lot of locals are seeing the possibility of growth and to some degree actually are enjoying having more restaurants, having more shopping. But yes, I've definitely run into those that are moving out into, you know, I am not seeing people leave Utah though.
That's what's
interesting to me is when I first got in real estate here, 2004, I moved here. Typically we were constantly cross shopped with the other ski resorts. It was just a normal thing. And we do our field trips. We get in the bus as realtors and go and tour these resorts every year because we would lose so much business to some of these resorts. And we're not seeing that. You know, where people, if they're leaving Park City, they're going out into the counties.
With regards to counties and other areas, we focused on Camas, but I'd also like to hear your perspective on Wasatch County, Midway, Heber. What's going on there? And what do you feel like you'll be seeing in the future?
Absolutely. You know, I definitely the river factor in a lot of the other towns where people would have maybe chosen before. If you think about whether it's Aspen, whether it's Sun Valley, whether it's Big Sky, they all have rivers that go through. Midway just happens to have that beautiful fly fishing opportunity, Midway and Heber. And now they have the Mayflower. You know, and you have a private airport that is being used more than it's ever been used. If you drive by there lately, it's a parking lot. And so I definitely think Heber and Midway probably have the most upside right now as far as just short term, because you're going to have the infrastructure, the shopping and everything, but still be able to get acreage and views and outdoor life.
That's great to hear. We've been speaking with Paul Benson with Ingalls & Volker about three of their new shops they just opened up, as well as just real estate in general for Utah and the Mountain West. Paul, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you both. Have a great day.
Sending kids off to college is a big deal. College is the first step that sets up young adults for a successful future. Parents are excited to have helped pave the way, but are overwhelmed by the tuition bill, yes. It's a big price tag. And there may be some guilt that they can't afford the whole amount themselves. SoFi Brian Walsh is here to discuss tips to start planning now for your child's college education. Brian, thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So, sorry, I'm a parent who's right in this right now. So let's just start, you know, talking. Parents, they are thinking about their kids going to school. They may have saved a little bit in their 529 plan, but they know they're going to need to borrow money to pay for their kids' education. Where do they start?
Yeah, I think the first place to start is just making sure you're taking full advantage of your financial aid package. Work study, federal student loans, grants, scholarships, things like that. From there, we encourage people to really kind of build out a budget for what school is going to cost throughout the year. So that way we can plan ahead, we can reduce expenses where we need to. And then last but not least would be picking the loan that fits best based on what you want to do, whether it be a parent loan, a private student loan in the student's name, things like that. So I think we typically kind of go through that three-step process to figure out the best answer to that question.
Well, let's take a step back into a little context. You know, people are certainly aware that the price of college tuition and fees has gone up much higher than inflation over the last, say, 20 years. But give us a bit of a perspective about, you know, what kinds of costs parents are looking at for a four-year college education at this point.
Yeah, so I think on average, what we're seeing for a four-year in-state school would be in the ballpark of low 20s to high 20s for tuition and room and board. But it's important to keep in mind, though, a lot of parents look at the sticker price that they see online. It's really important to consider the net price, which would be what comes into play after financial aid, because that's going to vary a lot since most families do get some form of financial aid.
With regards to financial aid, is that the office that I'm talking with at the school, or is it different for each individual school?
Yeah, it would be different for each individual school. So once you get your financial aid offer back from a school, you could work with that school to ask questions about it, to go through the process, and really kind of compare and contrast the different options that you have available to you.
And do the schools link you up with loan possibilities, or is that something you end up doing independently?
Yeah, it's going to be a little bit of both. So schools will typically have a list of lenders that they work with and are integrated into their systems that certainly make things much easier. At the same time, they typically won't endorse, let's say, one lender over the other. So it leaves it up to the families to figure out what's going to make sense for them based on the lenders that are available, which honestly is a great thing for families because it takes a little bit more work, but it can give the opportunity to check your rate with multiple lenders to make sure you're getting the best deal rather than just hopping right into the first one that you see.
That makes sense. I know that there's quite a few key terms that people should be looking at and understanding while they go through this process. Can you maybe go over those and then also talk about like subsidized and unsubsidized loans?
Yeah, so I think the first area that we start kind of discussing would be the FAFSA, or the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. And really, that's going to be the form that families fill out, where you put in, you know, parents' income, parents' assets, student income, student assets. And that information is shared with the institutions that you're exploring and ultimately end up going with, and kind of used to determine, hey, what's the financial need for this family? Historically, that need was measured by an acronym called EFC, or Expected Family Contribution. That's actually changing to the Student Aid Index. Very similar concept, just called a slightly different thing, essentially looking at saying, hey, how much this family can they reasonably afford to send their kid or multiple kids off to school? From there, you really start looking at the financial aid package itself, where you'll see grants or scholarships, which are essentially free money. You'll see work study, which is one way to think about it, is it's earned financial aid, where you actually have to work on campus to get that money. And then last but not least, you'll see student loans. And the question there is subsidized versus unsubsidized. And I guess families don't really get to decide that. It's based on their need, where both are federal student loans. Subsidized means the interest wouldn't start accruing while you're in school. Unsubsidized means the interest would start accruing when you're in school. So subsidized would be a little bit better because it would save you a little bit of money on the interest accruing while the student's in school.
And are the interest rates on those loans floating upward, as we're seeing all interest rates float these days, or are they being held static?
Yeah, so they are set once a year by Congress. So essentially what happens is every year Congress will set the interest rate for subsidized, unsubsidized loans. And then the next year is kind of broader market interest rates change. Those rates would change. But once you take out a federal loan, so let's say you took one out this year or next year, that rate is going to be locked for the remaining period of that student loan.
Many parents look at either co-signing the loan or, what are the impacts short-term and long-term for parents being a co-signer on that loan?
Yeah, I think it's a tough struggle for a lot of parents, because most students can't get approved for a private student loan on their own because they don't have a credit history, they typically don't have income, so they may need a co-signer. And it's just important to keep in mind before you co-sign what that means. And essentially that means if the student can't make payments down the road, then they're going to fall on you as the co-signer. So you just need to make sure, hey, is this going to blow up my personal finances if I have to take on these payments? If so, you might want to think twice, even though it may kind of limit the options that your student has to borrow money.
So help us understand, there's a layer of loans available that are federally backed, either subsidized or unsubsidized. And the amount that you can borrow, I take it, is determined by the analysis of the FAFSA. When is it that I get into the private loan layer? I would have to get into the private loan layer? Would that be because I couldn't borrow enough from the federal loan level?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Typically what will happen is families will max out what they can get for, whether it be subsidized or unsubsidized, student loans. And then if that's not enough to cover tuition, room and board, then that's where other types of loans would come into play, whether that be Parent Plus loans that are going to be in the parent's name, or whether that be private student loans in the student's name or even in the parent's name, after you exhaust what those federal loans would be.
And I'm going to ask you a very precise question. Does that happen a lot?
honestly, it does. Most of the times when we're working with families, we will see someone when they graduate college, they'll have 12, 16, 20 different student loans, because for each semester, you'll take full advantage of the federal student loans, and then you'll maybe add a private student loan on top of that. So you will have a pretty high number of student loans depending on how long it takes you to graduate.
So as we start looking at repayment options and parents helping their kids repay those loans, how should parents prioritize what they pay now versus later, as well as saving for the retirement?
Yeah, I think when it comes to taking out student loans, at least on for private student loans especially, a lot of times the default is to say, okay, we're not going to make any payments on these loans until the education is complete. But the downside is interest is accruing on those loans as soon as you borrow that money. So it may make sense to say, okay, can we make interest-only payments? Or maybe we pay 25, 50, 75 bucks a month. So that way, you, when you start paying the money back after graduation, you're not paying back more than you borrowed because of interest along the way. Now, the challenging aspect kind of integrating this with a parent's overall finances is parents, we really encourage them not to put their own financial future and own retirement in a really tough spot by either taking money out of the retirement accounts or borrowing too much money in their own names and putting that in jeopardy, because there's no student loan equivalent for your own retirement. So sometimes that can kind of create some awkward situations and tough situations for families.
We've been speaking with Brian Walsh. He is with SoFi, and he's been helping us with some tips of how to pay for college. Brian, thank you so much for joining Mountain Money.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.